At this time, this wacko should briefly qualify. Requirements for chairing a meeting at the Central Orlando Group Saturday night speakers meeting are 1 year of continuous sobriety, have Central as your home group, and attend the group conscience meeting. Sorry, I'm knocked a little off game there. My name's Mike Stevens. I'm an alcoholic. I've been sober since July 29th, 1987. People like you saved my dying, undeserving carcass from just sliding off the end of the world and dying in an ocean of alcohol. I was simply miracled in, and in was a good treatment center in the San Fernando Valley of Southern California. What they did was pound in this program into my beady alky head, and I just bought it all from the beginning. I bought it all before I knew any of what it all was other than staying sober. But I knew that you and people like you were staying successfully sober and appeared to be getting happy, fully engaged lives. And that had become a foreign thing to me. And I wanted it. So thank you for my life.
Thank you.
I am really happy about this rascal who's being the speaker tonight. I've known Raymond since I first found Central over 20 years ago. I was about 3 years and some months sober, and found myself in Orlando from L.A. doing a television series for Universal. Never been the state, much less Orlando, but I found the Central Group very quickly for the months I was here on that show. And there was a young, ponytailed, unapproachable young man who led a Friday night meeting, and I became a regular at that meeting. I loved that meeting, and I didn't dare tell him at the time, but really liked him. And I am thrilled that Raymond, who I would truly, literally trust with my life and my wife's life, to hear him give his lead tonight. By the way, turned 30 years, an old timer in this program, that young ponytailed anger management guy.
You bring tears to my eyes, Mikey. My name's Raymond, I'm an alcoholic.
Hey!
I feel kind of privileged and very honored. This is the first time I spoke at this group, and it's been my home group for 30 years. This is the first time I've been able to speak here in 25, so maybe it'll be a little bit different and not full of the excitement it was at one time. My drinking, almost, I'll start at the beginning, what the fuck. I have to get that out of the way, sorry. I was born into a military family. I was born in Guantanamo Bay, Cuba in 1960, right before the Cuban Missile Crisis. My parents were down there twice. My mother absolutely loved that island, would love to go back to it if it wasn't in the state of disarray that it's in now. But I'm one of two that were born down there on that same day. But I'm the second born of that family and the oldest, and that's pertinent later on. Being born into a military family, I found out later on there was a lot of expectations of do what you're told, stand up, take responsibility for yourself, you know, be there, and there was a lot of pressure as far as that went. And that was just a part of my life. There was a lot of things not done in my family that, you know, were normal for me, but when I saw other families doing it, it looked odd for me. One, my family never openly said that they loved any of the kids, ever. You were expected to be seen and not heard. Do what you're told, period. You know, get on with it. If you had a problem, you were told to figure it out. Watch and learn. So I did a lot of that. My father was real strict. My father was a drinker. And from a very early age, I got to experience both sides of him. The sober, kind, caring, you know, type of person whenever he was at the house. And then the drunk, the violent, not caring, you know, homicidal drunk. I literally kicked around a lot when I was a kid. And I thought that was normal. A lot of violence in my family. My father was drunk. And that played a role later on. I learned not to be afraid of bigger people. You know, because I was real small. I was 135 pounds when I got to this program. And mean as a snake. I thought it was normal. I thought everybody was like that. When my drinking, when I started, after watching all that stuff go on with my family, when my parents divorced and my father left, I had nothing else to, you know, I had nothing else to go by. I started drinking a little bit at a time. My parents had my mother had a little homemade wine kit at one time. And I remember, this is the first time I drank, I remember getting into that and not being able to stop. Started drinking from the first drink, I was never able to stop until it was gone. That should have been an indicator for me, but wasn't, like most of us. While my father was still at the house, he was very, and I would say a proud person, but he took a lot from me, not knowing that he did it. Sports activities and things like that. I was playing sports, baseball, loved baseball. My hero actually was Johnny Bench. I don't know if any of you younger people can remember him, but, you know, I started out as shortstop. I got hit between the eyes with a ball, walked around like a raccoon for a little while, and couldn't play any other position out in the outfield, so they put me behind the plate. And I found a home back there. I discovered something about the position of catcher. Controls the whole field. It's not the pitcher. It's the catcher. I loved it. Control issues. Loved it. That was my place. And we went to a game one night. My father decided that his sons weren't playing enough, so he pulled us out of it. Never for me to never return to that. That was very devastating for me at the time. He just took away everything that I had at that point as a kid. And that's where the resentment really started that I had towards him. When my drinking started to progress, that hatred that I developed for him and some of the people around me took on the same form. I swore I'd never be like him. That was another thing. I swore I'd never turn out like my father. I ended up starting to go to jail, and they were all violent crimes. A lot of fights, pent-up aggression came out with me. I was always able to work. I started working legally when I was 16 and continued to work through all that. I started working as a carpenter at a young age, and I stayed with that company even through my drinking. They were drunks anyway. I'd get drunk, get in a fight, go to jail, get out of jail, they'd hire me back, you know, great enablers. But I stayed with those people for a long time up to the point that I got sober. But throughout all that, the intensity of the anger and the hatred got deeper and deeper and deeper. And for me, when I drank, I'd pick up a drink and I wouldn't be able to stop. The last 2 years that I drank, I intentionally tried not to drink. I would go to jail, come to do my shit, get out and be drunk before I got home. And knowing what was going to happen. No one did it anyway. Couldn't stop. Once I started drinking, I couldn't stop drinking, no matter what, until it was either, I was either passed out, knocked out, or, you know, whatever, or locked up. The confrontations with the police started to get kind of exciting for me, because I was at a point when I was 19 years old that I didn't want to live any longer. Through one of my dad's drunken rages when I was a little bit younger, he pulled out a firearm, pulled out a shotgun, and started pointing it around at people at the house. And I was one of them he pointed it at. And it seemed like that thing was at me for a long time. But I don't remember feeling any real fear at that time. I knew what a firearm was. We were grown up around them, taught how to use them, shown what they could do. And, you know, the whole deal with the responsibility between picking up a firearm, pointing at somebody was put in my face. I was taught how to use guns, clean guns. I was shooting expert by the time I was 9 years old with a high-powered rifle. And I knew what they were. I knew what they would do. I knew everything about them. And the fear after that happened kind of set in. But I kind of, it just kind of was there, and I didn't know how to deal with it, so I kind of buried it. That came out later on in my drinking. I had a guy pull a gun on me, and I got right up in his face, dared him to pull the gun, pull the trigger, pull it. He wouldn't do it. Pissed me off. The last confrontation I had with police officers through my drinking, and I had to read about this. I don't remember a whole lot of that evening. I don't remember what triggered it. Don't remember anything about it. I remember coming out of a blackout with my hand around my mother's throat, her up off the ground, up against the oven, choking her to death. I remember people trying to pull me off her. I remember getting another fight in the house. I remember being calmed down. I had a friend in the neighborhood that was real good with me. He started a few years before that teaching my brother and I about meditation, because he saw the addiction with the alcohol, and he was trying to help. Even though he wasn't an alcoholic or a drug addict, he was just trying to lend some help. The meditations and stuff helped me for a while until I quit doing them. They also did something else that I wasn't really expecting. They taught me how to channel pain and how to block it out, which was probably not a good thing for me. But the last time that I had the altercation with police officers on that level, it took seven of them to put me in the back of a car. I was 135 pounds, keep in mind. Seven of them put me in the back of a car. Two of them went to the hospital at that point. I got down in the cage. I kicked another guy's face in. He went to the hospital too. Needless to say, they beat the shit out of me. I spent 3 days in a padded cell till the swelling went down enough for me to go up in front of a judge. Unbeknownst to me, there was enough witnesses to say that they started it. So they dropped all the charges. At that point, that was my last drink, and I had enough at that point. I had enough. I didn't want anybody around me. Didn't deserve to live. Knew I didn't deserve to live. Pissed off because I couldn't find somebody to kill me. And I had just had enough. I came to in a padded cell that one morning, shackled and handcuffed, beat badly again, and gave up. It's the first time I ever asked for any help. And there was one old man in the room. Evidently he was there when they brought me in, but he was squatted down, leaned with his back up against the wall, waiting for me to come to. And I kind of half knew he was there, but when I got up, I just asked for help. And that's the only thing I uttered. At that point, some kind of peace came over me that I'd never experienced in my entire life. And I couldn't explain it at the time, but I knew everything was going to be okay. I just knew it. No matter what happened to me, I knew it. had a probation officer at the time that was looking to put me in prison for 20 years under habitual offender. And I was willing to go. I was willing to do whatever it took at that point just to get this over with. They put me in population. I don't play well with others. They took me out of population. Put me in a solitary confinement, which I was okay with. And this little short black guy, about Brent size, not as, he's a little cuter than Brent, but came in and he interviewed me for something. I had no idea what he was talking about. They gave me this, it was 10 questions at the time. I think it's up to 20 now for you guys that are a little anal retentive. But it was 10 questions. It's the first thing I've ever passed in my life, just to find out I'd fucking flunked as a human. And that I was doomed to have this the rest of my life. I found that out later, by the way. About a month went by and they put me in a treatment center, treatment cell up there in the old Orange County Jail. And they, you okay, John?
Sorry. Yeah, I'm not drunk or high.
You're doing good.
I just wore out from work.
That's not bad. I know. But they put me in this treatment cell up there. And the first thing I saw when I went in there was this huge black guy with a 2.5-inch fingernail bouncing it off the end of a white guy's nose. I said, well, shit. He just put me back where I just got out of. Fuck it. You know? Come to find out later on that this was supposed to be the cell guy, you know. The thing that was real strange about this is this cell was real clean. There was actually lights on in it. And there was an apology made a couple hours later. Everybody was called into the day room and they there was an apology made, which kind of floored me. This is not typical behavior for a jail. So I said, we'll see what happens here. It's the only time I kept my mouth shut for about 2 weeks. And I haven't stopped talking since. But the thing that I found in there, I felt comfortable in that cell, or in that cell block, I should say, because I found out just about a year ago that it was a maximum security jail cell, and they put murderers, bank robbers, and thieves in there, and I felt comfortable with all of them. I felt comfortable in a small environment. I felt comfortable with those people. That was the first clue that you know, I had a long way to go. The thing that I look at, but they did everything that they asked me to do. And I didn't exactly break any rules while I was in there, but I bent the shit out of a lot of them. And I had to do a lot of writing. And it was a small sentence, but it was the sentence said I'll be more aware of my surroundings. You know, and after writing that about 10,000 times after a few things, I started becoming a little bit more aware of my surroundings. That has stuck with me for 30 years, being more aware of my surroundings, being where I'm at, what I'm doing, who I'm with, what's going on, being aware of people and what they're going through and what they're doing. And I started going through the typical treatment process and everything. Well, it's not typical for most of you, but for me it was typical. That if they thought you were full of shit, they'd tell you. I thought it was pretty nice, but evidently that didn't work when you get out here with the normal people. The thing that I look at, I started going to AA meetings up there. And there was 3 men and 2 women that used to bring meetings up there, Mondays and Fridays. 3 men, 2 women. The 2 women have passed on since, but the 3 men are still sober today. They've never picked a drink up. Everyone got 30-plus years, every one of them. Those men would bring that meeting in there religiously every Monday and every Friday. Without fail, there was always a meeting there for us. They brought that. And I know these guys had something better to do on Friday night, you know, because I would have had something better to do on Friday night. But they were there, and they still go to meetings today. Both 2 of them are members here, and they come here. You see them every day. That kind of set me thinking, you know, maybe there might be a little bit to this deal, because I don't know. head was going like this all the time. And when you're unsedated, it really goes like this for a while. Well, they ended up, and I swear to God, somebody did something wrong. They ended up letting me out. I did 209 days in Orange County Jail, and they let me out. They gave me a year. I found out later on that the con artist that was the counselor of the treatment cell conned my probation officer into allowing me. He said, if he's going to mess up, it's going to be within a year. You've got nothing to lose here. You know, let him try this way of life, see what happens. If he's going to mess up, it's going to be in a year. He was right. 11 months, 2 weeks, and 3 days into it, I messed up. And I had to go tell my probation officer about it. He told me to get the court date postponed. Let it go. Somewhere in that year, he saw a transition occur with me. From the drunk, violent, dangerously antisocial person that I was, that he knew for a little while, to where I was at that year, he saw a transition, and he said, you know, postpone it. I didn't hear this conversation. You know, I said, and I really didn't understand or grasp what had happened at that time. I really didn't understand and grasp the changes that were taking place with me. When I came into this program, I was walked from the Orange County Jail over to Jackson Street. That's where we were meeting at the time. And it was an old building with a kitchen, some meeting rooms, winos in the back, drunks inside. And they were all old people. And I'm 20 years old. I'm like, this is going to suck. And after the guy told me this is where I'm going to go to meetings, I said, okay. We went over to Halfway House. I spent 9 months at the Halfway House getting my shit together. But I went to meetings over there for a couple months before they moved over to this other building that's no longer there. And went to meetings there. Religiously. Still hateful. Still unapproachable.
Very much so.
I had long hair. It was getting long again. I had to get it cut to go up in front of the judge. It was down to my ass. Blonde. I was cute.
You were scary. You were a scary dude back then.
And I had... But I had to go through some shit to readjust into this society through Alcoholics Anonymous. I met some old timers over there at the old club. Most of them didn't like me. A couple of them took me under the wing. Whether they liked me or not was not the point. They knew something about this program that I didn't at the time, and that most people don't. That if you stay around here long enough and you make a half-assed attempt at this, your life is going to change. And they knew that. They knew that. No matter what I did, they knew that. And I kept coming back there in spite of it. I've been back to jail 3 times sober. I'll probably go back to jail again. I got this defiant attitude that won't go away. And it's not as bad as it used to be, and I don't know if that's due to, well, I just don't want to be into shit or it's old age. But it's diminished over the years to where, you know, I think before I engage my mouth 90% of the time, and I try to be a little bit kinder to people today 90% of the time, and the rest of the time I just really don't want to have a perfect record. You know, I just really don't. Got to do something wrong just to make sure I'm still human. It took me a long time to get from feeling like a piece of whale shit to becoming semi-human. I don't want to get perfect. I got 30 more years for that, I hope. You know, but I started going to meetings, and these guys, no matter what I did, would talk to me. They would say good morning to me or good afternoon or hello, you know, and it made me feel welcome here. Some of them didn't. I started branching out and going to a lot of different meetings. We had 900 meetings here a week in this area at the time. We had meetings everywhere. And I was asked to don't drink and go to meetings elsewhere from a majority of them. And that was fine with me because I went back anyway because I was told to go. I could go. This is where they were going to save my life. And there's a part in the big book that says we don't care how violent you are. or anything else. You can recover from this if you keep coming. So I wrote on that, you know, and I would rub it into your face real quick. I didn't have any problem with it. That's the only time the defiance has really paid off for me. I worked a lot of hours. I worked anywhere between 70 and 100 hours a week. I had no time for myself, and what time I could get to meetings, I went. And I loved the 11 o'clock meeting on Friday night that we used to have here, because that was a lot of times the only meeting that I could get to. I chaired a meeting over at the other place on Wednesday night, about 5 years sober. I chaired that meeting for 3 years. Every Friday night, or every Wednesday night at 8 o'clock, I chaired that meeting. That was my meeting. I did not miss that meeting. I don't care if I was just sick as a dog, I was at that meeting. Because these people instilled in me, you have no excuses for not getting to one. None. You know, you'd crawl down the damn road, puking your guts out, half naked, in a thunderstorm with hail coming down to get a drink. You've got no excuses not to go to a meeting. None. But this is the commitment that I made when I got here. That I was in here for a different way of life. You know, I didn't even care if it was better. I just needed different. And I got it. I served every position in this group because they got me involved in service work. I used to wash ashtrays, used to clean chairs, used to clean the puke up off the carpet in the other room. Used to do all that stuff because they told me to do it and it would help me. Not that I could see that at the time, but they said it would help me. They said, you do stuff. And there was requirements sometimes for some of the service work I did. I had to do stuff for somebody and not be found out about it and not tell anyone. Period. You did it, and you got on with it. I was told about loaning money in this program. I learned that lesson. It cost me $3,000, $20 at a time. I'm a little thicker than most. I did get 20 of it back. I don't remember ever loaning it, though. I don't ever remember seeing this guy, ever. But he gave me the money back and told me that I was kind enough to give it to him one day. I don't remember. The point was made with me at that point. You give without expectation here. I found out a few years later about prayer and meditation again. 8 years in this program. I was the GSR for this group, and I was putting out flyers. I love this daily reflections book, because at that point, this is when they were gathering information, and they wanted people to submit stories to this, the daily reflections. And I was a part of helping this group submit some of them. And along in this area, and I was taking flyers around. I listened to a guy, I was over in Winter Park at the Fairbanks group one night at a speaker's meeting, and I listened to a guy get up there, and I wasn't expecting anything. I was there just to pass out flyers. And he was given his triple X-rated version of his sobriety, which I'm given tonight. And I sat there and listened to that man tell my story that night. At that point, I felt truly at home. That there was somebody else out there that went through what I went through, that had recovered from this. And I was 8 years sober at the time. And that concreted my commitment to this program and to life, actually. Because up to that point, I was still doing some pretty wild shit. They were building all these first big tall high rises downtown and everything, and my big thing was hanging off the side of the buildings up there doing work. I loved it. Just off a little thin piece of rope. It was great. You know, not knowing whether I was going to get home or not. Watched a guy walk off the side of one of the buildings one day. That was pretty cool. Well, it was, actually. Because it wasn't me. The only thing that happened to him, and I started realizing there really is a God in this world, because there was a buck hoist at one side where he fell, and there was a crushed rock pile at the other side, and he fell into a sand pile that was just dumped there that morning. The only thing that happened to him was he broke his arm here, and he fell from 7 floors.
Wow.
That's the only thing that happened. And I said, you know, I kind of feel that way today, that's what's happened to me. You know, as bruised and banged up as I got, and there's always been a hand there to help me cushion the fall. and that was just through a little bit of willingness. I started touching on these steps and this program and everything early on, but just as much as my brain could deal with, and I had to just take it as a real piecemeal. I didn't come in here like Dr. Bob and do that shit, even though I admire him a whole lot more than I do Bill. I admire his ability to stand up and take responsibility for what he'd done, and to try to make the effort to change his life, and to let a God direct him in that. I kind of admired that. And I started taking this as I could. And a lot of these things that I started feeling, and a lot of these things I started seeing about my family, my father, and about me, didn't start really occurring until I was around 5 years sober. That was a major transition point for me. I found out later that that's a point most of us don't make it past. And it takes a certain amount of honesty and a certain amount of humility to get past that point in order for your life to change. My life started changing at that point. I started doing a lot of things. I started feeling, you know, productive. I started feeling really, really good about what I was doing. Other people thought I was pissed off as a motherfucker, but I felt good. That was the point, right? You know? And the thing that I look at today is it's been real. The soul searching that I do on a daily basis, the things that I have to look at are me and how I conduct myself, how I feel about people, and being able to deal with those emotions, because those are the things that get me in the most trouble, is not being able to do things. Because I still like to do wild, crazy-ass shit. I mean, I'm off the wall. I've never wanted to have ever been settled down, and that came from moving around as a kid and never having a true home, which for me has been a benefit. I've been able to do a lot of things that you know, I just dreamed about before. I love that part in the Big Book that says, bring your dreams to AA. I used to sit in front of the TV every year and watch the Indianapolis 500. Loved that. I didn't like the race cars. You know, going around a fucking circle just really didn't do it for me. But I love watching the guys jump over the pit walls when the cars would come in. I loved it. Get that car up, wheels off, gassed up, wheels back on and gone. That excited my ass. I was being sarcastic one time with a guy. He took me to a race in Sebring. And he was a PR guy for a racing team. And I just, you know, whatever, let's go. I'm not a spectator, but I'll go down and entertain you. We went down, we watched the race, and I spent most of my time down in the pits watching these guys. And after the day was done, we spent the weekend down there, the last day, he asked me, well, what do you think? I said, you know, it would have been a lot better if I had something to do. Wrong. The next day I was down at the race shop scrubbing tires. All that practice I had cleaning ashtrays helped. I'm scrubbing racing tires. And I worked down there, they were getting ready to go to Daytona. And 36 hours later, we were packing the trailer up. 2 hours later, I was in Daytona with them. After the date, and it was spent a week over there, after that, I was called into the owner's office and asked if I wanted a job. I spent 2.5 years with that race team traveling the country. That was a dream that I had. I didn't ask for that. That was a gift. That's all that was a gift. I got to live out a dream. And I met some very wonderful people. I've met some filthy, flipping rich people. Beyond anybody in here sitting in wildest dreams. You know, the one guy that we ran the car for spent $1.5 million every year just to play with his car and let us play with it and never thought about it. If we needed something, we got it. Never missed a race. He actually bought the series to help keep it up. I got to know him and his wife very well. And normal people. Very normal people, very caring, compassionate, you know, loving people. And to get them away from that and talk to them, You never knew they had that kind of money. I respected them people. I learned to respect those type of people. And I got to meet some very famous people, famous race car drivers, people that have made history, and talk to them. I got to meet Joe Kittinger a couple times, and some other people that were just famous in history. And they're normal, just like us. You know, and it was very wonderful for me to come from where I am, where I was at, and get to do this with these people. And they treat me like a human being. It was just phenomenal for me. My life really started changing around that point. I've done a lot of different stuff. I've done a lot of different things for work. There hasn't been anything that I've tried that I haven't been able to do. That comes from watching and learning and doing. And that's what this program is, watching, learning, doing. That's what it's been for me. I watch these people. I watch their lives change. I learn what they do when I do it, and it happens for me. Today I sit up here, or stand up here. I think this is Mike's effort to get me to sit in a meeting for the whole meeting. I'm kind of convinced of that because, you know. But sobriety today, for me, is being able to go to bed happy, go to bed peacefully, and being able to wake up in the morning and enjoy the sunrise. Never did that drinking. Didn't do that for a little while sober. The head was down. You keep coming back here, your life will change. Some of it quickly, some of it not. You know, I talk to a lot of people who get to a roadblock and get discouraged. They say in the big book, do not be discouraged. I love that part. You know, I really do. What an order. You know, it's like, holy shit, I can't do this. Yes, you can. Take it a little bit at a time. You know, don't do any more than God wants you to do, and be happy with yourself, because life is changing. I'm grateful to be a part of Alcoholics Anonymous. It's a worldwide organization. I can go anywhere and sit in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous and be at home and know I have friends anywhere. You know, and that's not the alone part for me. The alone part is when I didn't have my God in my life. You know, I can go anywhere and be by myself and be at perfect peace and never feel alone today. There was a time that was not the case. You know, I make the effort every day to do the inventory, and I don't wait till the evening. A lot of times I do it during the day. You know, it keeps me from saying a lot of stupid shit that I really mean. And it helps me be a little bit kinder to people. I found people in here that love and care about me, which I thought I was never deserved that. You know, in spite of myself. You know, I've gotten better. And I appreciate Mike allowing me to talk tonight. I really do. I appreciate this group tremendously, even though it's gone from the what it was to what it is today. You know. And hopefully it'll be a lot better tomorrow. So I'm grateful to be here. Thank you for all showing up.